from Elarina Respighi, and a suite for orchestra based on an old poetic tale of two witches. We heard the Ballad of the Gnomes as Jeffrey Simon conducted the Philharmonia Orchestra on Kansas Public Radio. It's 1:25, and in the second half of the hour coming up, we await the Cleveland Orchestra and music by Richard Wagner and his take on the tale of Faust, a concert overture still to come in about 20 minutes' time. Support for classical music on KBR comes from Stoneback Appliance in Lawrence. Locally owned with real people that answer your call, not a machine. Details and information at stonebackappliance.com, where we've got your back. And I2S at KU, developing and researching new technologies, educating technology professionals, and providing service to the region and nation. More at i2s-research.ku.edu. Next on KBR, we're with the musicians of the ensemble Mozzafiato, and chamber music from someone who was one of the great students of Franz Josef Haydn, the Austrian composer Ignaz Josef Pleyel, was a great composer but who mainly distinguished himself in the business side of the musical world, owning a music publishing business as well as a piano-making manufacturer. We'll hear a sextet in E-flat major by Pleyel next on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you.
the ensemble Mazzafiato, performing a sextet in E-flat major by Ignaz Josef Pleyel of Austria here on Kansas Public Radio. The music may not have been Mozart, but music of Mozart is going to be coming to our neighborhood very soon. This weekend, as a matter of fact. Catch Mozart's Requiem, the Kansas City Symphony and Chorus's performance of the Mozart Requiem. Two performances tomorrow and Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Kauffman Center, and a 2 p.m. showing this Sunday. Find out more about Mozart's Requiem and how to attend over at kcsymphony.org. Kansas Public Radio is 91.5 Lawrence, 89.7 Emporium, always online at kansaspublicradio.org. At 7 tonight, it'll be Classics Live. Then from 8 to 9, Destiny has Tango Thursday. Happy Halloween and Tango Thursday tonight. Some spooky tunes and one of the most famous tangos of all time. Destiny has that for you tonight from 8 to 9. Support for classical music comes from Cromwell Environmental, serving Kansas and Missouri since 1982, with a variety of environmental services from indoor air quality and mold services to energy audits and solar energy installation. More information at cromwellenvironmental.com. Time for music by Richard Wagner, who in 1839 had an ambition to write an entire symphony based on the legend of Faust. The symphony never materialized, but he did create the following concert overture, the Faust Overture, with the Cleveland Orchestra led by George Zell, next on KPR. completed in 1840 the concert overture Faust by Richard Wagner, played by the NES Chamber Orchestra, or excuse me, the Cleveland Orchestra, here on Kansas Public Radio. It is 2 p.m. News from NPR is just ahead. In the next hour of classical music, we'll begin with music by Danny Elfman and the theme from Beetlejuice, and go on to hear music by Bach. Kansas Public Radio is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute. Support for news comes from KU Theater, presenting Hookman, a darkly comic salute to teenage slasher films, reminding everyone that college can be scary, playing tomorrow through Thursday, November 7th. Tickets at KUTheater.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Vice President Kamala Harris is campaigning out west today, as is former President Donald Trump. Both have stops in Arizona and Nevada, while Trump is also going to New Mexico. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Harris is trying to drive a contrast with Trump.
At a rally last night, Trump said he's going to protect the women of this country.
I'm
going to
do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them.
Harris took notice.
He does not prioritize the freedom of women and the intelligence of women to make decisions about their own lives and bodies.
This race is shaping up to have a potentially historic gender gap, with a significant share of women supporting Harris, while Trump appears to be performing better with men. Tamara Keith, NPR News, traveling with the vice president.
As for the running mates, Governor Tim Walz spends part of the day in Pennsylvania at a temple celebrating Diwali. Diwali, the Hindu festival of light, celebrated in Indian communities worldwide and amplified in the U.S. this year by Vice President Harris's South Asian heritage. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, Trump's running mate, Senator J.D. Vance, held a town hall at High Point University in North Carolina. The campaigns are fiercely competing for the swing state's 16 electoral votes. The Brookings Institution says the number of Democrats registered to vote in North Carolina has fallen since 2020, while the number of Republicans has gone up, cutting the Democrats' edge from nearly 400,000 in 2020 to just 113,000 this year. The Israeli military is intensifying its ground incursion in northern Gaza. It says it's battling Hamas militants who have regrouped there. Recent airstrikes have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians. Many killed are women and children, according to health officials. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports the attacks are affecting hospital operations as well.
The Kamal Adwan Hospital in the Jabalia area of northern Gaza has been struck several times this week by the Israeli military. An attack today destroyed the third floor of the building, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The Israeli military says it was unaware of a new strike, but has said Hamas militants operate out of the hospital. Health officials said the attack damaged much-needed medical supplies and medicine that had been delivered by the World Health Organization just days ago. Kamal Adwan is one of three hospitals in northern Gaza that are now largely inaccessible due to the Israeli incursion. Aid agencies warn that almost no aid trucks have been allowed into northern Gaza, and the United States threatened Israel to cut off some weapons deliveries if it does not secure more aid in. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
U.S. stocks are trading lower this hour. The Dow is down 219 points, or roughly 0.5%. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. MoreProgressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio.
We'll be right back.
it comes to Halloween, Danny Elfman gives you some good options. They're the main titles from Beetlejuice, the OG 1988 Beetlejuice, played there by the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra, led by Eric Kunzel. This is Kansas Public Radio. Classical music continues. I'm Jeff Watson. This hour, we'll listen to music from one of the great violinists of history, Heinrich Wieniawski. Some of his variations on an original tune, A Serenade for Strings by Ernst von Dachnanyi, all just ahead of us. Right now, we'll continue the Halloween spirit and hear music by Johann Sebastian Bach. This is a music by Bach that, to my way of thinking, has always had the sound of Halloween to it, much like his famous organ piece, the Toccata in D. This one was likewise an organ piece originally, the Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor. Its version for orchestra is given to us next by the Seattle Symphony, led by Gerard Schwartz, on Kansas Public Radio. Music with the sound of Halloween to it from Johann Sebastian Bach, Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor, performed by the Seattle Symphony Orchestra led by Gerard Schwartz on Kansas Public Radio, where it is 2:23. In about a little over 10 minutes' time, we'll hear a serenade for strings of Hungarian composer Ernst von Dohnányi. Support for classical music on KPR comes from the Topeka Symphony presenting Puttin' on the Ritz, with Rimsky-Korsakov's Procession of the Nobles and Grieg's Piano Concerto, performed by Cheung Park on Saturday. Tickets at topekasymphony.org. And Spider Arc Constructors, offering decorative stamped and stained concrete patio work across the KPR listening area. More information about creating your backyard oasis is at Spider Art, Spider with a Y, SpiderArcConstructors.com. At the KU campus, 55 degrees at the moment. Temperatures in the upper 50s for today, partly sunny skies. For tonight and your trick-or-treating weather, we should have clear skies and lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow's a sunny day and a little warmer with highs in the lower 60s. You have a 30% chance of showers tomorrow night. Next on KPR's violinist Maya Bizengaliev, joined on piano by John Lenihan, for some variations on an original theme from one of the great violinists of the Romantic time, Heinrich Wieniawski, next on KPR.
Thank you.
On an original theme by Heinrich Wieniawski of Poland, played by violinist Bart Bezangaliev, alongside pianist John Linehan, here on Kansas Public Radio. It is 2:36, and at 3 o'clock, time for All Things Considered from NPR News. That's followed at 7 o'clock by Classics Live, then from 8 to 9, an hour of classical music with Destiny and Mermegan, with Tango Thursday, as well as some spooky tunes for Halloween. That's tonight from 8 to 9 here on KPR. Once we're done with Halloween, the holidays will soon be upon us, and so will KPR's Big Band Christmas, coming up on Saturday night, December 14th, at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. It's the KC Jazz Orchestra, back to serenade you with some big band jazz and some holiday favorites, too. Tickets for a Big Band Christmas are on sale at Liberty Hall and at Ticketmaster.com. Made possible in part by Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles of Topeka. Tonight we should have clear skies and low temperatures in the upper 30s. Tomorrow is a sunny day and slightly warmer with highs in the lower 60s. Tomorrow night is partly cloudy, lows in the mid-40s, and a 30% chance of showers. Next on KPR is music by Hungarian composer Ernst von Dohnányi. Something that he wrote in 1904, a progressive work that brings to mind the work of Brahms, which was no surprise, as Brahms was a great champion of the music of Dohnányi, the Serenade for Strings, Opus 10. Conductor Asa-Pekka Salonen is back to lead the NES Chamber Orchestra on Kansas Public Radio.
Thank you. Thank you.
Asa Pekkasalanen and the NES Chamber Orchestra taking us through Opus 10, the Serenade for Strings, by Ernst von Dachnanyi, composed in 1904, here on Kansas Public Radio. Where it is for me to wrap things up for this afternoon's classical music, I'm Jeff Watson, and I hope you've enjoyed listening. Stay with us for All Things Considered from NPR News just ahead. That's followed by Classics Live at 7 p.m., then Destiny as an hour of some Halloween music for you. That's from 8 to 9, here on Kansas Public Radio. We're live, we're local. Kansas Public Radio is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for All Things Considered comes from Burt Nash, offering a wide range of services for youth and their families, including therapy, parent support, and case management. More information at burtnash.org. And the Topeka Zoo. celebrating 90 years of smiles, memories, wildlife conservation, and education. Open daily from 9 to 5. Calendar of events and ticket information is found at topekazoo.org. It's 3 o'clock. This is KPR.
He is my president and he thinks I am garbage. Yeah, that definitely make me feel bad.
Voters are processing the final twists and turns of the presidential campaign as the candidates make their final pitches today in the Southwest.
For Thursday, October 31st, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Ahead this hour, harnessing the popularity of Mexican music as a way to harness the power of the Latino vote.
If you really want to move the needle, you really need to target that 43 out of that 63 million, which are those of Mexican descent.
Also, Sing Sing Prison just hosted its first film festival with a jury of incarcerated men.
I've never been a part of like a film festival. I've never really seen it. Didn't really think it was possible for people who grow up how we grow up.
And a new discovery in how parrots get their colorful plumage.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Former President Trump's using some of the limited time he has left before Election Day, detouring from battleground states to court votes in traditional blue states. Today, it's New Mexico, but the Trump campaign's gambling that it can capitalize on inroads the GOP's made among registered Latino voters, especially Latino men.
I like them. They're smart. They're a lot smarter than the person running for president on the Democrat side. You could say a lot smarter than Biden, too, I could tell you.
But Trump's stop today in Albuquerque comes against a backdrop of racist and inflammatory remarks made on the campaign trail, including a pro-Trump comedian's poorly received joke that Puerto Rico was garbage. Vice President Kamala Harris says Trump's remark that he'd protect women, whether they, quote, like it or not, is very offensive.
In terms of not understanding their agency, their authority, their right, and their ability to make decisions about their own lives, including their own bodies. And this is just the latest on a series of reveals by the former president of how he thinks about women.
The Democratic nominee speaking to reporters in Wisconsin before she also left a campaign in Southwest battlegrounds. Homing in on a crucial battleground, Pennsylvania, NPR's Windsor Johnston reached out to voters in suburban Philadelphia to find out how they plan to vote.
Mohammed Qureshi is a registered nurse who lives in Philadelphia County. He voted for Donald Trump in 2020, but he says he's supporting Kamala Harris in this election mainly because of her stance on reproductive freedom.
Patient should be given a choice what they need to do, what is dangerous for them. A person cannot go for an abortion even if she's having medical issues because our government decides to go ahead and put a ban on it.
With 19 electoral votes at stake, Pennsylvania could play a critical role in the outcome of the election. Recent polls show about 3% of voters there remain undecided. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
An IV fluid production plant damaged by Hurricane Helene is partially back online. Here's NPR's Sydney Lupkin.
A Baxter International factory in North Carolina had to shut down more than a month ago because of flooding from Hurricane Helene. Before being knocked out of commission, the factory made 60% of the IV fluids used in hospitals around the country. The resulting shortage means hospitals are conserving IV bags for the neediest patients and postponing or canceling some procedures. The Biden administration invoked the Defense Production Act to help Baxter get materials needed to clean and rebuild the factory. Now Baxter is restarting production lines of the most commonly used IV fluids. It'll take time for the new supplies to reach hospitals, however. The first batches of IV fluids won't be shipped until late November, Baxter said. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
This is NPR. Officials in Spain now say more than 150 people have been killed in this week's flash flooding. About 1,200 emergency workers have been deployed to Valencia and other affected regions. Some areas remain inaccessible as rescuers try to clear vehicles and debris from mud-caked roads and restore communication links. Arturo Valoria de Rana is one of the Red Cross volunteers currently in Valencia. He says people were trapped in shelters.
They're trying to recover as soon as possible their normal lives. And many people were here in Valencia working or just passing, travel from home. They are just trapped here in Valencia, and many other people here in these shelters are coming from the surrounding small towns, waiting to know about the roads in order to reach their homes.
De Arana on the BBC. 8 of Mexico's 11 Supreme Court justices have tendered their resignations. Here's NPR's Zeta Peralta.
Mexico's Chief Justice Norma Piña made her resignation letter public, saying it was an act of dignity and intellectual honesty. This summer, Mexico's ruling party won the presidency and an overwhelming majority in the federal and state legislatures. They immediately passed a constitutional amendment that makes all federal judges elected by the people instead of appointed as they are in the U.S. 8 of 11 Supreme Court justices now say they will not participate in those elections next year, that the elections politicize Mexico's judiciary, and that they imperil judicial independence. Next week, the court will also weigh whether the constitutional amendment that changed their jobs is constitutional. Eder Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, committed to a healthier future for all Kansans with health care coverage for businesses and their employees. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business.
57 degrees in Lawrence, 59 in Manhattan. It is 3:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are reaching out to voters in the Southwest today. They're in the swing states of Nevada and Arizona. We are joined by NPR's Ben Giles, who's in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi there, Ben.
Hello.
And KUNR's Lucia Starbuck in Reno, Nevada. Hi to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, I can hear that you're somewhere noisy, so Lucia, you kick us off there in Nevada. This is the first time, I am told, Harris has been in Reno this year. How big a deal is the visit?
Yes, I'm right outside the rally. It's a really big deal. She hasn't been to Reno since 2023 in her vice presidential capacity. She's been to Las Vegas several times since becoming the Democratic presidential candidate, and she'll be in Vegas again today. But in northern Nevada, which is more rural compared to Vegas, voters tell me they sometimes feel forgotten. Sandra Cosgrove, a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada, says these campaign visits matter.
For the community, it tells them the value of their vote. So presidential campaigns have a ton of money to be able to advertise and send mailers and text messages. But if that's not working and they're really having to count individual votes, they're going to show up and talk to you.
Cosgrove said campaign visits are enough to convince people who might have sat out this election to vote.
And Ben, let me turn us to Arizona, because if you were wondering about its importance in this campaign, we can point out that both major candidates have been there a lot as well. What are the closing arguments you're hearing?
They sure have. And the Trump campaign here has been pretty consistently focused on Arizona's economy. They talk a lot about the cost of living, particularly the cost of housing and how much it's gone up. And that is top of mind for many voters here. Trump will argue the economy is worse under the Biden-Harris administration than under his 4 years ago. And they've also sought to tie the economy to immigration. They've done that by blaming migrants as added competition, contributing to the high demand of housing. Economists who've studied this question say immigrants do have a minimal impact on housing costs. That is, if supply can't keep up with demand, but again, minimal.
I'm hearing the same thing from voters in Nevada that are struggling with the high cost of living. They want to hear from both Harris and Trump on how they'll fix it, especially those working in the service industry.
Okay. Let me turn you both to some comments that have made a lot of noise, a lot of headlines in the last few days of this campaign. These are the ones from a comedian speaking before a Trump rally in New York, comparing Puerto Rico to a floating island of garbage. Given that the Southwest has a sizable Latino population, I'm curious what you're hearing from people in these two states. Lucia, first Nevada.
Yeah, my colleague Maria Palma, she spoke to Raymond De Leon Perez, a Reno resident of Puerto Rican descent, who said it's motivating him to encourage others to vote.
Horrible, honestly. It makes me feel bad
made me feel bad for my kids, for my wife, for my family, for my Puerto Rican people, but also gave me strength to go outside and knock doors day by day and make people understand why Kamala Harris is our best choice in this next elections.
Since those comments, Trump has said he has a lot of love from Latino communities.
Ben, how about in Arizona?
Yeah, it's certainly something the Harris campaign has sought to seize on here as well. The chair of the state Democratic Party earlier this week was doing interviews on Spanish language radio channels, slamming that floating island of garbage comments made by a comedian about Puerto Rico.
Although Democrats are having to do damage control on this as well, President Biden made comments sounded like he was calling Trump supporters garbage.
Yeah, I checked in with a couple of Republican voters in Nevada, including Paula Loop, an immigrant from Argentina.
He is my president and he thinks I am garbage. Yeah, that definitely made me feel bad, and I cared about what he said and how he said it.
She compared it to Hillary Clinton's deplorable comment she made when she was running for president in 2016. Biden has since tried to clarify his remarks, saying he was talking about the comedian at the rally, not Trump supporters.
One more issue to ask you about, and that is abortion. Ben, in Arizona, abortion's on the ballot. Polls show this measure is likely to pass. How could that impact the race?
Well, Democrats certainly think it's an issue that could play into the presidential election here. As part of their last week on the campaign trail, the Harris campaign launched a reproductive rights freedom bus tour throughout Arizona, featuring guests like former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Democrats up and down the ballot, not just Harris, are hoping that the same people who are turning out to vote in support of a constitutional amendment to protect the right to an abortion in Arizona, that'd be up to about 24 weeks, they're hoping they'll also remember what Trump did to put the state in this situation.
And Lucia, just a few seconds left, but abortion's also on the ballot there in Nevada?
Yeah, the stakes are not as high. There's a ballot question to make it a constitutional right to have an abortion. If it doesn't pass, abortions are still protected under state law up to 24 weeks. But Democratic candidates are still making it a main campaign issue, and it's definitely on the minds of a lot of voters as well.
That is KUNR's Lucia Starbuck in Reno and NPR's Ben Giles in Phoenix. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
We've heard a lot on this show about the potential power of Latino voters, but getting Latino people out to the polls in representative numbers has been challenging. One concert promoter thinks that he has an answer, which harnesses the growing popularity of regional Mexican music. Reporter Aisha Wallace Palomares brings us a story about this Get Out the Vote campaign.
The campaign is called Grita Canta Vota, and it has its own theme song by the super popular norteño band Grupo Control. They're singing, shout, sing, vote. The future is in your hands. I caught up with the campaign's co-founder, concert promoter, Esau Torres, at an election event in Northern California.
Today, everyone who checks their voter registration is
going to... Esau says the future is in the hands of Latinos because they are the second largest racial demographic in the United States, at a little over 63 million people. But they also have the lowest voter turnout.
If you really want to move the needle, you really need to target that 43 out of that 63 million, which are those of Mexican descent, which is why you hear us talking about, you know, the Tucanes, the Javis, the Banda MS, the Grupo Control.
He's name-dropping the Mexican regional artists involved in a free concert series he helped organize to register voters in battleground states like North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada.
So October is like our Super Bowl. We have events all over the United States.
SOU adds that if you want to encourage Mexican Americans to vote, you have to speak directly to them and do it authentically. No shade to Bad Bunny or Karol G. They're world-renowned Latino artists, but they're not Mexican. So can this Mexican regional music Super Bowl of voter registration efforts really move the needle? I asked Mike Madrid that question. He's a political strategist who wrote The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. He says it's a cool way to reach out to younger voters, but he's skeptical.
They're not looking to entertainers to change their lives. They're looking to entertainers to escape from their lives. That's what entertainment often is. I'm not convinced that without a message as to why and how this is going to actually change your life, that it will work.
The Free Get Out the Vote concert series ends on November 1st in Laveen, Arizona, with Eslabon Armado. Probably best known for Ella Baila Sola, the first Mexican regional song to reach a billion streams on Spotify. For NPR News, I'm Aisha Wallace Palomares.
50 years ago, Muhammad Ali fought George Foreman in what is now called the Democratic Republic of Congo, the rumble in the jungle. Emmett Livingstone reports from Kinshasa.
I'm here in Kinshasa's Tata Raphael Stadium, where 50 years ago, the legendary Rumble in the Jungle fight took place between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. For Mobutu Sese Seko, the leader of what was then known as Zaire, the title fight was an opportunity to showcase his country to the world and to lift its reputation. But for ordinary Congolese people, the event represents something much, much larger. Behind me, young Congolese boxers are circling each other in the ring, all of them inspired by Ali's victory 50 years ago.
The poorly advertised event only attracted about 100 spectators, slightly less than the 60,000 who turned up for the Rumble in the Jungle. 24-year-old Congolese boxer Landry Matete Kankonde is sitting ringside watching the bouts. He reflects on the legacy of the Rumble in the Jungle. It's like the foundations of a house. It represents a lot for us, says Balu, a silver medalist in this year's Africa Amateur Boxing Championship. Congo is a country of boxing, and most Congolese boxers draw inspiration from Muhammad Ali. 50 years ago, millions tuned in to watch the fight. The build-up had been frenzied. Ali was the underdog.
I got into the ring and I hit him with everything I had.
This is how Foreman described the fight to Mary Louise Kelly on this program back in 2016.
He survived, and after about 6 rounds, he started whispering, "Oh, you got George. Show me something, George." And I knew this was a frightful moment.
And in the 8th round, Ali delivered the knockout blow.
Muhammad Ali has won. Muhammad Ali has won by a knockdown.
On that night, the world's attention was for the first time focused on Congo for a positive reason. Muhammad Ali represented the pride and defiance many black Africans felt in an era of racism and apartheid. Judex Chipanda, who's 71, recalls training with Ali in Kinshasa before the fight. In 1974, he was 21 and still a competitive boxer. Chipanda even lifted the ropes for Ali as the boxer stepped into the ring. One memory sticks out. Ali Boumaye. He asked everyone to chant that. Ali Boumaye means Ali kill him in Lingala. Chipanda and the crowd were chanting it as Muhammad Ali delivered the uppercut that knocked Foreman to the ground. It was clean and beautiful, says Chipanda. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
This is NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming a cappella group Straight No Chaser in their Top Shelf Tour, Wednesday, November 13th, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next hour, Puerto Ricans will elect a new governor on Tuesday. For the first time in decades, an upstart political movement is posing a viable challenge to the island's two main parties. News headlines and a whole lot more still to come on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Public Library and its Civic Engagement 101 series, discussing the Electoral College, November 14th in the Library Auditorium. Details at lplks.org.
Following All Things Considered this evening on your KPR One stations, classical music with Destiny, wishing you a happy Halloween and a happy Tango Thursday. You'll hear some spooky tunes and also one of the most famous tangos of all time. And, of course, as part of Classics Live, Destiny's Halloween concert. So lots of destiny coming up tonight on your KPR 1 stations. Over on KPR 2, we have KPR Presents, followed by The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. Clear skies tonight with a low in the upper 30s. Bundle up out there if you're wandering around looking for some treats. And be sure if you're out driving, slow down. Use a little extra caution. Be on the lookout for kids trying to cross the street. It is 3:20.
For NPR comes from the station. And from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Across the country, anti-Trump sculptures have been popping up mysteriously. Anonymous guerrilla art has a long history in politics. So what should we take away from these new statues? Here's NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Well, it looks like a new monument downtown.
Last week, WUSA 9, a local news station in Washington, D.C., reported on one sculpture.
Looks like a bronze statue of Nancy Pelosi's desk with, well,
a giant turd on it. And there's a plaque ironically honoring the, quote, brave men and women who broke into the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021 to loot, urinate, and defecate through those hallowed halls in order to overturn an election. In Philadelphia, a statue of former President Trump was placed behind an already existing statue of a nude woman with a plaque quoting his infamous line about grabbing women. And the news station, Coin 6 in Portland, reported something similar.
A satirical statue of Mr. Trump suddenly appearing this morning on Southwest 6, opposite a longtime statue of a nude woman.
This isn't abstract sculpture. You don't need an art degree to figure out what these statues are saying. But there's something going on here beyond the surface-level electoral politics, says Faye Gleiser, associate professor of contemporary art at Indiana University in Bloomington.
They're not changing how people are going to vote. That's not really the point. At the same time, I do see possibilities in them if we come to them as questions instead of answers.
One obvious question is, who put these up? An anonymous caller contacted New York Magazine, taking credit for the Philly and Portland statues, saying it was a way to remind people of certain things about former President Trump that had become, quote, forgotten or numbed or normalized. There's also the fact that whoever put up the poo desk in Washington, D.C. got a permit, which can be read as part of the art. Gleiser wrote a book called Risk Work. It's an examination of guerrilla artists from the 60s or the 80s and how they evaded or didn't evade the carceral state, a.k.a. the cops. And filling out paperwork was an important part of that.
This very seemingly mundane act of having a permit for a temporary installation is actually much more revealing of the ways that artists become theorists of our everyday lives and how space is governed and managed and surveilled.
But permits are temporary, and so is art. The Portland and Philadelphia statues are already gone. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Sing Sing is a maximum security prison north of New York City. It hosted its very first film festival last week with the help of the Marshall Project. A jury of incarcerated men weighed the merits of a variety of criminal justice documentaries and picked a winner. NPR's Mark Rivers was there.
Corrections officials brought festival guests through several layers of security and into the campus's chapel, which that day served as a meet-and-greet area. Like any film festival, there were photo ops, knots of people wearing name tags talking excitedly, a table laden with refreshments. And if you didn't notice who was wearing green slacks, you might forget that some of those guests and participants were also incarcerated.
I've never been a part of like a film festival, I've never really seen it, didn't really think it, you know, it was possible for people who grow up how we grow up.
That's Michael Hoffler. He's incarcerated at Sing Sing, and this was a big day for him. He served on the jury, along with four other men.
We don't even know how our names got thrown in it, but we just received call-outs, and they said, all right, y'all have been chosen to participate.
Could you have declined? Could you have said
yeah,
that?
No, you could have declined.
Okay.
But it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
That experience came to life largely through the efforts of the Marshall Project. They brought in a filmmaker to train the men on how to judge technical aspects like storytelling and cinematography, and the men were encouraged to use their experiences with the criminal justice system to evaluate the film's authenticity.
Their words, their thoughts have value and it has weight, and I'm glad to be able to help bring that to the world.
Lawrence Bartley was a driving force behind the event. Bartley himself had been incarcerated at Sing Sing. After his release in 2018, he joined the Marshall Project, where he creates print and video journalism. He said the Sing Sing Film Festival shines a light on the thoughts and feelings of people society tends to undervalue.
They are human beings. They're human beings with hopes and dreams and wants just like everyone else.
One of the selected documentaries was For Our Children, which centers women seeking justice for their sons who had been victims of police brutality.
It's a call to action for all mothers to come together.
We laugh, we cry, we're going to continue to fight.
Sitting in Sing Sing's auditorium, Alex Aguilar, an alternate juror, said the film made him think about his childhood.
Like, I really grew up thinking like it was normal for police pick you up, take you out your car, search your car. If they want to, they could beat you up. People don't realize how that just makes you angry because you realize like you've gone through that.
Daughters, another of the documentaries, follows the lives of four young girls as they prepare for a father-daughter dance at a D.C. prison.
These girls just needed a way to invite their fathers into their lives on their own terms.
Watching the film, Michael Hoffler thought of his own children.
Being incarcerated don't absolve us of our responsibility as a parent. We did what we did, but we still have a responsibility to help raise these children that we left.
And for Jonathan Mills, at 61, the oldest of the jurors, his experience watching the films and discussing them with the other men showed him he still had room to grow, if only given the space.
For me, it's therapeutic and a little bit healing, and it helped me develop my better social skills, you know what I mean? Because I'm, you know, a key to myself, you know what I mean? If I don't really actually know you,
I'm not as charismatic.
And I realize that now.
The Sing Sing Festival was inspired by the first ever film festival for incarcerated men, held at San Quentin State Prison earlier this month. Rahsaan Thomas, known for co-hosting the award-winning podcast Ear Hustle, co-founded the San Quentin Festival.
What these programs do, they excuse for proximity. They bring people from different worlds together.
At Sing Sing, festival planners leaned into that proximity, giving guests, jurors, and other incarcerated men hours to mingle before the official program began. And during the program, some of those men took the chance to address top prison officials.
I think my question really is more for Commissioner Monticello.
That's one of the incarcerated men at Sing Sing, and he's directing his question about resources directly to Daniel Monticello, the commissioner of New York State's Corrections Department. Monticello stepped up to a mic and responded.
We got to figure out the staffing thing, because without that, we can't do all the things that we do. There's a lot of ideas out there, and I don't say no on first blush to any of the ideas that are out there.
Finally, the big moment arrived. Lawrence Bartley did the honors.
The most relevant and the most deserving of the first ever Sing Sing Film Festival Award. Are y'all ready?
Contessa Gale's film, Songs from the Hole, received the top prize from the jury. She said her film, about an incarcerated musician processing his brother's death as well as his own past, belongs to the men of Sing Sing.
Every time that we've had a film festival screening on the outside, we've made sure whatever city we're in, that we're going to also bring the film into a prison. And to have the jury here be all comprised of incarcerated people and for them to, you know, honor us with the award means everything.
Juror Alonzo Miles says, although Songs from the Hole took the top prize, all the films provided equally vital portraits of a system that he knows well but doesn't define him.
These types of films are very important. There's no loser here today when it comes to these films. All of these films are winners when you look at them and understand them.
And as today's events showed, a little understanding can go a long way. Mark Rivers, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The English rock band The Cure broke into the pop music scene in the 1980s. Later, they took a 16-year break.
I sort of thought I'd written everything I had to write, but as it turns out, I haven't.
The return of The Cure on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning, beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations, 5 to 9 a.m. Morning Edition, coming your way with Jay Schaefer as your host.
Support for KPR comes from Stoneback Appliance in Lawrence, locally owned with real people that answer your call, not a machine. Details and information at stonebackappliance.com, where we've got your back.
Stay tuned. News headlines are coming up next. Clear skies tonight with a low in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, more sunshine with a high in the lower 60s. Rain moving in on Saturday and staying with us through Election Day. It is 3:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Today, many Hindu Americans celebrate two holidays, Diwali and Halloween.
One is a festival of lights, the other of darker things.
If you want to keep tradition alive, you have to flex, you have to just honor both, because they're also growing up in this world where all their friends aren't doing Diwali.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. 5 days left before Election Day, and both presidential campaigns are trying to connect with female voters and anyone still undecided. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke in Wisconsin today before setting out to campaign in the western battleground states of Nevada and Arizona. Harris pushing back on Republican nominee Donald Trump's comment today that he would protect women whether they like it or not. Harris calling that offensive to everybody.
Our campaign really is about bringing people together. People of very different and diverse backgrounds around a common theme that is about love of country, defending the Constitution of the United States, and investing in our future, and rejecting the notion that we are divided or that that should be acceptable, that we would be divided as a nation.
Meanwhile, former President Trump is campaigning in New Mexico and Virginia, where Republican presidential candidates haven't won in decades. Millions of voters will weigh in on key criminal justice issues next week in the form of ballot measures, as NPR's Meg Anderson tells us some of those initiatives may signal a shift toward tougher crime policies.
In Colorado, for instance, a measure would increase the amount of time people convicted of certain violent crimes have to serve in prison before they can be eligible for parole. And in California, a proposition would turn certain misdemeanor theft and drug crimes into felonies and lengthen some prison sentences. Lauren Bonds of the National Police Accountability Project says she sees these measures as a backlash.
Most of the ballot measures that we were voting on in 2020 were more progressive in nature in terms of reducing penalties, and now we're really seeing a reaction to that.
The California initiative directly undoes several progressive changes made in the state a decade ago. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Commissioners in Wyandotte County unanimously approved a resolution yesterday to promote expanding language access in local elections. Advocacy groups have urged the Secretary of State and the County Election Commissioner to provide voting information, ballots, and language assistance in Spanish. Micah Kubik, the Executive Director of the Kansas ACLU, says language assistance would improve representation in all of the state's largest counties.
It would be a good thing for our democracy, for our community, if election-related information were available in the languages that folks here speak.
In a statement, the Kansas Secretary of State's office said it provided Spanish language election materials in other counties where federal law requires it. A literacy program at the only women's prison in Kansas is helping incarcerated mothers and grandmothers connect with their young family members. The program, operated by Fort Hays State University, helps some of the women at the Topeka Correctional Facility boost their reading abilities. It also gives them confidence to read aloud to their children and grandchildren when they visit or provide recordings for their loved ones. Sarah Broman Miller is an education professor at the university. She says the program allows women to bond with their children.
This one woman said that her daughter listened to that recording every night, and that was just her way of being tucked in by her mom.
Prison officials say the program helps with inmates' mental health and prepares them to re-enter public life. The American burying beetle was once found in 35 states, but it is now federally threatened. Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke reports on efforts to conserve this spooky beetle that is native to the Midwest and the Great Plains.
At the St. Louis Zoo, buckets are filled with dirt, quail carcasses, and American burying beetles.
So I have here a male.
Underground, these bugs process dead animals into meatballs to feed their babies. Burying beetles are basically the cleanup crew of the ecosystem, says Kayla Garcia, the zoological manager of invertebrates.
Without animals like burying beetles, you know, we'd have a lot more like kind of dead, decaying stuff on the surface, and also a lot more flies.
A range of ecosystem changes are putting pressure on the American burying beetle. Experts say people can support these beetles and the animals they eat by planting native plants. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kate Grumke.
Clear skies for this Halloween night, lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high in the lower 60s. 30% chance of rain late tomorrow night, low in the mid-40s. 70% chance of rain on Saturday. Nearly a 100% chance of rain on Saturday night and Sunday. It's 59 degrees in Emporia, 63 in Chanute.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The high price of housing is top of mind for many voters. Home prices have gone up 50%. That's just in the last 5 years. With the election inching very close, both candidates have promised to bring down the cost of buying or renting a home. Here to talk us through what they are proposing is NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Hey, Laurel.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So I can attest firsthand, having sold and bought houses this summer, housing prices are really high. So let's talk through what the candidates are proposing. Start with Vice President Harris.
So she talks about housing regularly in her campaign speeches, and sometimes she makes it personal. She will remember how her mother saved up to buy a home and her mother's pride when she bought it. And then Harris hits the highlights of her plan, as she did earlier this week near the White House.
As president, I will fight to help first-time home buyers with your down payment, take on the companies that are jacking up rents, and build millions of new homes.
So you heard there are a couple of key ideas that she talks about a lot. First, Harris wants to build 3 million new housing units. America is millions of housing units short, and increasing supply would help bring down rents and mortgages. Mm-hmm. So to amp up that construction, especially at the cheaper end, Harris wants to expand the existing tax credits that are used to build affordable rental housing. And she wants to create a new tax credit that would incentivize building more starter homes. All the housing experts I spoke to said that this focus on supply is the right idea. And then there's that $25,000 in down payment assistance for first-time home buyers that she mentioned, though there is some concern that that could actually drive prices higher.
Wait, hang on. Why would it drive prices higher?
Well, it's about supply and demand. And if you give a bunch of people an extra $25,000, that will increase demand, which there is already a lot of these days. I spoke to several economists, and they said that these payments to buyers will just bring more bidders for a limited number of homes, and that would drive up prices. So on the one hand, the credit for first-time buyers would help those people compete with others in this tough market, but it could just boost prices. And that extra $25,000 at the end goes to the seller.
Okay, so great time to be a seller. What about on the Republican side? What about former President Trump?
Well, one thing he's been talking about a lot is opening federal lands for housing, and that's an idea that Harris also supports. But he has other plans that are less detailed. At a rally last month in Arizona, he lamented the current mortgage rates. They were a little over 6% at the time, but Trump overstated them by several points.
Today, the mortgage rates are at 10%, 11%, 12%. You can't get the money. We're going to bring it down very fast. We're going to bring energy down. We will drive down the rates so you will be able to pay 2% again, and we will be able to finance or refinance drastically.
So mortgage rates did dip below 3% at the end of Trump's presidency, but it's been more than three decades since they hit 10%, and they're far below that level now. And of course, the president doesn't set mortgage rates or interest rates, though his or her policies can affect them.
Laurel, I do want to note that Trump and his vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, they have both blamed undocumented immigrants for driving up housing prices. How much truth is there in that?
Well, this is another exaggeration, though there is some effect. I spoke with Albert Size. He's an economist at MIT, and he said that immigrants do increase housing prices, just like any population growth does, if the supply doesn't keep up with demand. But he said the effect is not nearly as large as the Trump campaign has made it sound. Though the effect would be larger in an area with a higher proportion of immigrants. Trump has talked about a potential mass deportation of illegal immigrants. That would mean fewer people in the country, but it would also mean fewer construction workers, and that could make building more expensive.
Thank you, Laurel.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
NPR's Laurel Wamsley.
In recent days, Puerto Rican voters in the U.S. have been at the center of the political conversation after a comedian at a Trump rally insulted their island. Now, voters on the island cannot cast a vote for the next president, but on Tuesday, they could usher in a new political era for Puerto Rico. For the first time, they could elect a governor who supports the territory's independence from the United States. That would be a rejection of the two parties that have long dominated there. Many Puerto Ricans blame them for the island's economic problems. For more, we're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido. Hey, Adrian.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so tell us more about this candidate for governor and why he represents potentially big changes for Puerto Rico.
Well, his name is Juan Dalmau. He's run twice before for governor, but he's never come close to winning because he does not come from one of the two main parties. In Puerto Rico, there are no left-right parties like we have in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The political system is built around the question of the island's relationship to the U.S. So there's the party that supports Puerto Rico becoming a U.S. state and the one that wants it to remain a U.S. territory. Dalmau, this new candidate, is from a third party which supports complete independence. It's always been a minor party, but this year Dalmau is polling neck and neck with the pro-statehood candidate Jennifer González-Colón.
Interesting. So what's going on here? Like, why is this pro-independence candidate polling so well against these historically dominant parties?
Well, primarily, and somewhat ironically, Elsa, it's because he's telling voters that this debate about whether Puerto Rico should become a state or a country or remain a territory, that should be put on the back burner. Dalmau's argument is that this decades-long obsession with the status question in Puerto Rico has led local politicians to basically neglect Puerto Ricans' basic everyday needs. Mm-hmm. Good jobs, a stable power grid, decent health care. And in any case, he says local politicians have no real say on status. Any change would require congressional approval. Here's Dalmau in a video he posted this week.
Y le hemos puesto al país la oportunidad de que en estas elecciones lo que se decide no es el estatus político.
The opportunity we have in this election, he said, is to decide not our political status, but who's going to administer our government, who's going to put our house in order.
Which sounds like a pretty straightforward platform that's focused on everyday issues, right?
It is, but it's hard to overstate how radical an idea it is to put this political status question on hold, because it always has been at the heart of the island's politics. Mm. But Dalmau adopted this idea from an upstart party that first put it out there 4 years ago and that he's now in a political alliance with.
So why is their message resonating with so many people, especially now, you think?
Well, because Puerto Rico has been in an economic crisis for almost 20 years. It's been trying to claw its way out of massive crippling debt and bankruptcy. A federal control board has slashed government services. The power grid's in terrible shape. There have been corruption scandals. Young people have left in droves because they can't find jobs. And they blame all of this largely on those two main parties that have always dominated politics. This is University of Puerto Rico political scientist Mayra Vélez Serrano.
In Puerto Rico, we have to talk about the crisis generation. These young people from 18 to 30, they have not seen a Puerto Rico in progress. They just have seen a crisis after a crisis after a crisis after a crisis.
Now, also, there's no guarantee that Juan Dalmau is going to win the gubernatorial election. Polls are showing a very close race between him and the pro-statehood candidate, Jennifer González, who is the island's non-voting representative in Congress. She's got a lot of institutional support, but Dalmau's message of building a Puerto Rico where Puerto Ricans can imagine a future for themselves has really struck a nerve, and if he wins, it would be a big shock to Puerto Rico's entire political system.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido. Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the deck and answers a big life question on NPR's Wildcard podcast. As host of NBC's Late Night, Seth Meyers is used to focusing on politics, current events, but for his new stand-up special on HBO, Dad Man Walking, he talks more about his family life, and he kept the focus personal in his conversation with Wildcard host Rachel Martin, reflecting on his early career at Saturday Night Live.
One, two, three.
Three.
Are you good at knowing when something should end?
Yes.
Relationships?
Uh-huh.
Conversations?
Conversations, definitely.
Disagreements?
Yes, I'm very good. I once, I hope I don't get in trouble for this. My wife and my sister-in-law were fighting once, and I walked out. It was like during a very fraught Christmas vacation. It was like too many people were in my in-law's house.
This is a classic recipe.
Yeah, too many.
Yes.
And they were fighting in the hallway. And I came out and I screamed, "You know, some people de-escalate." And they were both very taken aback. But I disagree.
It's easier to end someone else's
I'm very fight. Good. I know when to walk away from an argument. Mm. I think I'm really good at that way. I think I'm more often than not willing to take the L.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I think I'm happy to take the L in a disagreement for the purposes of moving on.
That's a thing I would hope to be able to teach my kids, is to have the confidence and security, emotional security.
Yeah.
Because it takes that to be able to say, I don't care enough about winning this.
Yes.
You win it. And it's okay. And I'm not giving you false winning. I'm really like, it's okay. I'm going to walk away.
Another thing. I feel like I was in, I think this is true of a lot of people, I was a far more temperamental when I was younger. And things ran very hot at SNL. And there were definitely times where my instincts were to say something that would have been relationship ending to people.
Oh, really?
You know, just you're having an argument and, you know, looking back, all shamefully petty, you know.
But you didn't say those things, or did
No, you? And one of the reasons I didn't say them is because my producer and dear friend Mike Shoemaker, who works with me now, works with me at SNL, I remember once saying what, you know, I'm going to go tell so-and-so, he's a you-know-what. And he used to always say, it's a long life. It's a long life. And the people that you work with here.
And you want a long career, yeah.
Well, it's not even about career. He's like, look, the people you work with here, what you are going through with them is going to, even for the ones that aren't your favorite people, this is bonding. And you will need, for the rest of your life, you will need these relationships to remember what this time was like. Mm-hmm. And these people, more of them are going to be at your wedding that aren't. And so I'm very happy I live by the adage of it's a long life. Because if it's somebody you think might be your friend in the future, there's no reason to burn it down in the present.
The new special is called Dad Man Walking. You can see it on HBO Max. It's very funny. It's worth your time. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Support for Wild Card with Rachel Martin comes from Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well. From everyday repairs to major remodels, reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
Morning Edition. You will hear it on your KPR stations, 5 to 9 a.m. Monday through Friday. Tomorrow is no exception. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
This month's KPR Community Spotlight's on Cherry Street Youth, an after-school program for students in Chanute. Now in a fundraising challenge to support the program with 100% match, doubling donations through the end of the year. Contributions welcome at cherrystreet.org.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, an update of news headlines. Then, you know, one of the old adages about Election Day is it all comes out to turnout, getting out the vote. We are going to examine how both the Trump and Harris campaigns are working to get out the vote in these final days of the election season. It's all coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Woodhaven, Inc., manufacturing custom deck and siding solutions using sustainable woods and powered exclusively by wind energy. Located in Perry with shipping available to the entire KPR listing area. Details at woodhavenproducts.com.
This is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence, and lots of other frequencies. They are listed for you at our website, where we're always streaming, kansaspublicradio.org. Clear skies tonight with a low in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, more sunshine, highs in the lower 60s. Rain moves in Saturday night and stays with us through Election Day. So soak up the sun while you can. It's 10 minutes before 4.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. It's October 31st, Halloween, which means millions of people are prepping their costumes and planning for trick-or-treaters. But for Hindus, Sikhs, and Jains, today is a holy day, too. Diwali, also known as the Festival of Light. From member station WFCR, New England Public Media's Nirvani Williams shows us how some Hindus are preparing to celebrate two very distinct holidays today.
You might remember this pop culture Diwali moment from The Office.
What is Diwali, you may ask? Well, that is essentially a Hindu Halloween.
Actually, that's not even close. As usual, Michael Scott from The Office is more than a little off. Diwali, pronounced with a V, is actually the Hindu Festival of Lights, which celebrates the triumph of good over evil and signifies renewal.
Hi, Vyasi. How are you?
Saritha Reddy is shopping for her Diwali celebration. She's holding a diamond-shaped cashew fudge in her hand, a favorite Indian sweet of hers called Kaju Katli.
This one have like saffron and rose petals in it. And if you see this is like a dry fruit filling like inside the sweet.
After she leaves the Indian grocery store here in West Springfield, she's also running over to Costco to grab candy. Her family is celebrating both.
Growing up here, they are like, you know, want to celebrate both of them, and they are giving some time for Diwali to celebrate, so I'm happy.
I like Halloween like a little, just like a little bit better because like I get to go trick-or-treating with my friends and get like lots of candy.
That's her 14-year-old son, Akshaj, who has a plan for the evening. He says after school, he'll change into a traditional Indian kurta outfit and have a small puja or moment of prayer dedicated to Lakshmi, the goddess of prosperity, with his family. Then he'll hit the streets for sweets.
I want to wear like a karate gi and like be like a character from my favorite TV show. It's called Cobra Kai.
But at a recent Indian folk dance festival, there were a variety of opinions about the overlap of Diwali and Halloween this year. 11-year-old Anjuri Gandhi, just a few years younger than Akshaj, says she prefers to keep the holidays separate because it's hard to find an outfit for both, and
they're like two different holidays, and it's like, it would be weird celebrating them together. It's like you're celebrating two like opposite things on the same day.
Diwali is typically a five-day festival where the biggest celebration, the lighting of candles called diyas, happens on the third day. 50-year-old Lena Thacker says a blend of holidays may just be too confusing for her nieces and nephews.
So it's hard to, with Halloween, it's very like the opposite, right? Like it's very dark and it becomes really difficult to blend. So it's better to enjoy each festival separately on its own.
But 24-year-old Nishta Patel says both can be celebrated together.
If you want to keep tradition alive, you have to flex, you have to adjust, and keep up with the times, and let them do both, honor both, because they're also growing up in this world where all their friends aren't doing Diwali.
And along with sharing American candy, Saritha Reddy says she can share her culture too.
I'm excited that Diwali will reach more people as they're falling on the same day.
So whether you're reaching for a Kit Kat bar, Kaju Katli, or both, one thing's for certain, your sweet tooth will definitely be satisfied today. For NPR News, I'm Nirvani Williams in Springfield, Massachusetts.
We hear a lot about red and blue in politics. What about the colors that Polly has picked? Ari Daniel reports on how parrots create the yellows and reds in their plumage.
Some birds are feathered tufts of color, so resplendent they do anything but blend in with their surroundings.
You have to ask why birds would do this. And one of the leading hypotheses is that the male has elaborate ornaments or colors that are attractive to the female.
Joe Corbo is a biologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Consider for a moment the goldfinch or the cardinal.
Most birds that have bright yellow or red feathers are using carotenoids to make those colors.
Carotenoids are a kind of pigment.
The reason that a bird's egg's yolk is a bright yellow orange is because it's full of carotenoids. And so then during development, the bird mobilizes the carotenoids from the yolk and then deposits them in the developing feathers.
And then, much like people need vitamins from food because the human body doesn't make them, once the chicks hatch, the only way for birds to get carotenoid pigments is for them to eat them.
So they obtain them from their diet.
There is a notable exception, however, and that is parrots. Roberto Arbore is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Porto in Portugal.
Parrots do it different. They synthesize their own pigments. They do not rely on what they get from the diet.
Scientists have known about these special pigments, but not really how parrots use them to create their diverse colors. So Arbore and his colleagues turned to the dusky lory, a parrot the size of an eggplant.
It's a very obscure species that lives in remote places. They come from Papua New Guinea.
The dusky lory is black and ringed with one of two colors.
Red or yellow.
The yellow color is actually dominant to the red genetically.
Joe Corbo says they were able to trace this either-or coloration, this red versus yellow, back to a single gene, one that they found makes an enzyme that shows up in lots of creatures. But in the dusky lory, the enzyme converts the red pigment into the yellow one by making a small change to the molecule.
And so the animal appears to be able to control the expression levels of this enzyme and thereby tune the relative ratio of red to yellow pigment.
When Corbo and his colleagues looked at another kind of parrot, the rosy-faced lovebird, they found the enzyme at work there too, doing the same thing. They suspect it's true in a wide range of parrot species. Just to be sure they had it right, though, they took the enzyme out of the birds and put it into yeast. Yes, yeast, and found it again made the color change they expected.
And this was the final proof. So now we know definitely a little bit more about how one of the most colorful groups of animals in the world make their colors.
The research is published in the journal Science.
It is a huge step forward in avian color genetics.
Rosalind Price Waldman is an evolutionary biologist finishing up her PhD at Princeton University who wasn't involved in the research. She says the findings open the door to asking what else these colors may reveal about parrots.
People are very interested in what the pigment content of a feather can tell us about an organism's health or stress or other aspects of its biology.
As for Roberto Arbore, he agrees this is just the beginning.
I will say it actually adds a new layer of magic. I never worked with parrots before, and now I'm considering working on them for the rest of my career.
Next up, Arbore says he and his colleagues want to examine the genes in parrots responsible for creating the color blue. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Irish writer Bram Stoker is well known for his novel Dracula. But years before that came out, he wrote another story that was lost for more than a century. That is, until someone recently found it, and the discovery has Stoker fans super stoked.
Immediately called each other, and I think probably swore more times than we ever have collectively on a phone call before, because we immediately thought, this is huge, this is global.
That story tomorrow on All Things Considered. Listen on your radio, online, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from EBSCO, offering EBSCO Learning, committed to enabling organizations and people seeking to advance their lives and careers to improve their skills and knowledge. Learn more at EBSCOLearning.com. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. Theory of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
After a 16-year break, the band The Cure has come back with music that even they describe as doom and gloom. Good timing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. It's 57 degrees in Lawrence and the time is 4 o'clock.
We have never let up. We organize 12 months a year. This is how we win, is by showing up all the time.
In the final days before the election, we check in on the Get Out the Vote efforts for both the Trump and Harris campaigns.
It's Thursday, October 31st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. If you are struggling with pre-election anxiety right now, we got some advice for you.
This is the week to pull out the business card of the therapist that has been sitting in the bottom of your purse for a couple months.
Also, the Biden administration says about 10,000 North Korean troops are now in Russia.
And it's Halloween. No better way to spend the evening than watching something scary and weird.
Not everything in the movie has to be explained, nor does it have to make sense. And I love it because it lets you just kind of exist in the horror and you leave with questions.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Vice President Harris is campaigning out west today, as is former President Donald Trump. Both have stops in Arizona and Nevada, while Trump is also going to New Mexico. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Harris is trying to drive a contrast with Trump.
At a rally last night, Trump said he's going to protect the women of this country.
I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them.
Harris took notice.
He does not prioritize the freedom of women and the intelligence of women to make decisions about their own lives and bodies.
This race is shaping up to have a potentially historic gender gap, with a significant share of women supporting Harris, while Trump appears to be performing better with men. Tamara Keith, NPR News, traveling with the vice president.
A House subcommittee investigating the national response to the COVID-19 pandemic is urging the Justice Department to launch a criminal probe of former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. NPR's Brian Mann reports the Republican-led panel alleges Cuomo, a Democrat, lied in testimony.
Cuomo has long faced criticism for his handling of nursing home residents hit hard by COVID-19. Republican members of the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic say the former governor made criminally false statements during an interview about his role with the panel back in June. They urged the DOJ to consider criminal charges. Cuomo denies any wrongdoing. His attorneys filed their own complaint with the DOJ, claiming the House panel's work is biased. This Republican effort to bring charges against Cuomo comes as former President Donald Trump is promising to use the DOJ to prosecute political opponents if he wins next week's election. Brian Mann, NPR News.
U.S. Special Envoy Amos Hochstein and Middle East Envoy Brett McGurk are both back in Israel today for talks about ending Israel's war in Lebanon against Hezbollah. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Tel Aviv.
Hochstein and McGurk met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss possibilities for a ceasefire in Lebanon. Netanyahu stressed that Israel's main concern remains returning citizens to their homes in the north, which means ensuring that Hezbollah has been pushed back from Israel's northern border. Tens of thousands of Israelis have been displaced for more than a year due to the frequent exchange of fire between Israel and Hezbollah. The war between Israel and Hezbollah has become increasingly deadly. Today, in northern Israel, 7 people, 4 of them foreign workers, were killed in 2 separate Hezbollah strikes. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, 30 people were killed by Israeli strikes just yesterday. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
For parts of the northeast and mid-Atlantic regions, trick-or-treaters definitely do not have to worry about wearing their winter coats over their costumes. costumes tonight. Above normal temperatures mean this year's ghouls, ghosts, and goblins can hit the street without any extra layers. The mercury forecast hit 78 degrees in New York, 76 degrees in Boston, 70 in Caribou, Maine, and even 80 in Washington, D.C. today. On Wall Street, stocks closed sharply lower today. This is NPR. The Los Angeles Dodgers are World Series champs again, beating the New York Yankees last night in New York 7-6. L.A. clinched the series 4-1, taking their 8th World Series title. But it's the first time for Dodgers star player Shohei Ohtani, who is from Japan. NPR's Rebecca Rosman has been following the celebrations in Tokyo.
The screams at the Hub Pub in northern Tokyo could be heard outside the door, with fans showing a special excitement for their national hero, Shohei Ohtani. McNeil Ledesma is a Californian here on vacation.
Finally, Ohtani has a championship, so I feel like this is a really big deal, and it's a blessing to be out here to celebrate with all the people from Japan.
The excitement here follows more than 3 hours of tense, heart-stopping concentration on what was a tight game. The Yankees led 5-0 in the third inning, but the Dodgers turned it around by the fifth, clinching the title after winning Game 5, 7-6. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Tokyo.
A representative from a moving company, along with lawyers, are expected to be given access to former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani's Manhattan apartment after he failed to meet a deadline to turn belongings over to two former Georgia election workers. The pair won a $148 million defamation lawsuit against Giuliani, who falsely accused the two of cheating during the vote count in the 2020 election. Giuliani had his bankruptcy case dismissed in July, opening his assets up for seizure. A federal judge last week ordered him to surrender those assets. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Dole Institute of Politics, hosting former Congressman Luke Messer and Sherry Bustos for their series Congress in the 21st Century, Wednesday, November 13th, 4 p.m. More at doleinstitute.org.
Lows in the upper 30s tonight, highs in the lower 60s. Tomorrow, it's 57 degrees in Lawrence and 58 in Topeka. It is 4:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Election Day is now right around the corner. While the candidates are still working to persuade the sliver of undecided voters, the parties are working at full force behind the scenes, checking lists of voters, making calls, knocking on doors to make sure people get out to the polls. But the two campaigns are taking different strategies this year to getting out the vote. Two of our correspondents who've been watching this are here to talk about it. And I want to start with NPR's Asma Khalid, who's been covering the Harris campaign. Asma, what does the Harris get out the vote effort look like?
Well, it is an ambitious effort. The campaign says it has roughly 2,000 staffers and 250 offices across the key swing states. Now, in terms of what that operation looks like, it's a combination of traditional phone banking and door knocking, you know, volunteers just making cold calls. And then it's also about relational organizing, people texting, say, friends and family. One thing I think that is worth pointing out is that when Harris became the Democratic nominee and replaced Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, there was this sudden surge of organic enthusiasm among different demographic groups. You probably remember those Zoom calls, right? It was like white women for Harris, Indian Americans for Harris. And even though these are ostensibly unaffiliated with the campaign, they are an extremely powerful organizing tool that, you know, frankly, Democrats did not have before.
You mentioned those demographic groups. Who exactly is the Harris campaign trying to reach in these final days?
Yeah, I mean, the campaign has a three-pronged vision in the key states, and it's pretty similar whether you're talking about Georgia or Pennsylvania. First off, the goal is to solidly win the cities. Secondly, they're trying to win the suburbs convincingly, and they think they have an edge on issues like reproductive rights and the threat that they believe Trump poses to democracy. They think that this could really resonate with college-educated voters in the suburbs. And lastly, they are trying to lose by less in rural areas. And to me, Ari, this is really interesting because to this point, you know, as an example, the campaign says about a third of their Pennsylvania offices are in counties Trump won by double digits last time.
So that's the Democratic strategy. And Republicans and the Trump campaign are trying something different with their voter outreach. So let me bring in NPR's Stephen Fowler to tell us, what does that effort look like, Stephen?
So, Ari, it's hard to directly compare the offices and staff and resources in these swing states. There's no direct comparison because Republicans don't share those numbers to the same degree. But it is less than the Democrats, partially because Republicans' key focus is on this program. It's called Trump Force 47. They're relying on grassroots volunteers with a lot of enthusiasm to be the ones doing the door knocking, talking to their own neighbors and friends in their communities, and also talking to people who don't often vote instead of primarily using paid canvassers. Now, the canvassers are still there, but those are handled mainly by third-party groups run by people like Turning Point's Charlie Kirk and billionaire Elon Musk. Here's Musk speaking at a Trump rally in Butler, Pennsylvania.
So thank you, and honestly, you want to just be a pest. Just be a pest to everyone you know, people on the street, everywhere. Vote, vote, vote. Fight, fight, fight. Vote, vote, vote.
But as you hear, these groups are inexperienced, and some Republicans I've talked to are worried about voters falling through the cracks.
How much does the ground game actually matter, Stephen?
Well, Republicans are seeing some of the fruits of their labor. There's been a surge in Republican turnout in many states so far, both of people who normally wait until Election Day to vote and those who may be early voting earlier. That, in theory, is going to free up more time and resources for Republicans to target those harder-to-convince voters to show up between now and Tuesday. It's also the third time Trump has run for president, and the campaign feels like Trump himself is the only get-out-the-vote effort they need to get them across the finish line.
You know, to that point, Stephen, you mentioned this is the third time that Trump is running. It's also the third time Democrats are running against Trump. And so they feel like they've got experience here. You know, I recall covering the 2016 election cycle, and the Democrats were essentially sort of blindsided by the organic enthusiasm for Trump. Ben Wickler is the chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, and he told NPR that after that shocking loss in 2016, they started a year-round organizing effort.
We have never let up. We organize 12 months a year. We organize in school board elections all the way to presidential elections. When there's no election, we have kind of mock dry runs and go knock on people's doors and check in with them about what they're thinking. This is how we win, is by showing up all the time.
Democrats feel they have really learned their lesson, and they know this election could be decided by just a few thousand votes in a couple of states.
NPR's Asma Khalid and Stephen Fowler, thank you both.
Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
The Biden administration says North Korean troops may soon be directly involved in Russia's war against Ukraine. That is according to the latest U.S. intelligence reports. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports this would mark a major escalation in Russia's nearly three-year-long war against Ukraine.
According to the latest U.S. assessments, there are about 10,000 North Korean soldiers in Russia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says 8,000 of them have already deployed to the Kursk region. That's the Russian region that Ukrainian forces invaded this past summer.
We've not yet seen these troops deploy into combat against Ukrainian forces, but we would expect that to happen in the coming days. Russia has been training DPRK soldiers in artillery, UAVs, basic infantry operations, including trench clearing, indicating that they fully intend to use these forces in frontline operations.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the North Koreans have been given Russian uniforms and equipment.
Make no mistake, if these North Korean troops engage in combat or combat support operations against Ukraine, they would make themselves legitimate military targets.
Russia's ambassador to the United Nations told the Security Council meeting Wednesday that his country's military cooperation with North Korea is transparent and part of a strategic partnership. Austin says it's a sign of weakness because Russia is suffering high casualties on the battlefield in Ukraine.
By tin-cupping to North Korea for manpower, Putin is showing the world another clear sign of weakness. The Kremlin's North Korean gambit just underscores how badly Putin's war has gone and how much trouble he's in. This is the first time in more than a century that Russia has welcomed foreign troops onto its own soil.
He says China, which Washington believes can pressure both Russia and North Korea, should be taking this seriously and asking Russia some hard questions. South Korean defense and foreign ministers echo that and say they might send weapons to Ukraine in response. At their meeting at the State Department, the U.S. and South Korean officials also expressed alarm over North Korea's latest test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Around Halloween, a trip to a cemetery can be part of a spooky adventure, a place where people gather to tell ghost stories. As Julie Denishay of member station KCUR reports, for some, visiting a graveyard is a way of preserving history.
It's a sunny fall day, and the leaves are just beginning to turn on the trees at Kansas City's historic Union Cemetery. About 20 people have gathered at the caretaker's cottage, a white clapboard house near the entrance.
Thank you so much for signing up for taking the class today. We're going to go on a little bit of a hike because we're going to go over to an area that's called Founders Row.
Heather Ferries is vice president of the Cemetery's Historical Society, which helps preserve the city's oldest public burial ground. There are 5,000 marble and granite markers here. Ferries will be teaching the group how to clean the gravestones without damaging them.
There's quite a few larger stones up there that we're going to work on today. If the stone has an orange flag, it's good to go. You can clean it, you can scrub it.
Earlier this year, the cemetery was awarded a grant to help preserve the tombstones. So far, volunteers have cleaned more than 300 of them. This group totes buckets and brushes as they pass the graves of John Calvin McCoy, often called the father of Kansas City, and Pony Express operator Alexander Majors. When volunteers, Savannah Jones Beachy is not cleaning headstones. She works on the weekend to help digitize cemetery records.
For me, it's very meaningful. I really enjoy getting to look up the facts about the people, so they're not just a stone. Sometimes these people's names haven't been spoken in hundreds of years.
Kaylin Witt co-hosts a dark history podcast called Ghoul's Night Inn that explores the culture and traditions of all things spooky. For her, there's nothing scary about being in the cemetery. She kneels in front of a marble tombstone decorated with carved scrolls and flowers.
I picked this one because it's really beautiful.
The epitaph is obscured by a thick layer of lichen. Witt sprays the marker with a biodegradable cleaning fluid that loosens the lichen without damaging the stone.
This is a very young person who is 18 years at the time of their passing, so I just want to give him some extra special attention today.
Witt gently scrubs away years of dirt with the bristles of a brush.
I've just always been fascinated by keeping people's memory alive and different ways that we do that as humans. It's such a human thing that we all do.
And as she scrubs, more details and carvings start to become uncovered.
So we can now see that this is a McCoy.
Turns out, it's the gravestone of Spencer C. McCoy, the only son of the founder of Kansas City. Spencer McCoy was born in 1844. He joined the Confederate Army and died during a Civil War battle in 1863. Both Union and Confederate graves can be found here, resting together. For Savannah Jones Beachy, working in the cemetery is her way of engaging with people from the past.
I like to talk to the person as I clean their stone. Some people might find that creepy or weird, but I think it's just very endearing to know that people are still here caring about you even when you've left the world.
There's nothing scary or ghostly at all about the work they're doing. It's all about preserving history and honoring the dead. For NPR News, I'm Julie Denishay in Kansas City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence. Also at 89.7 FM in Emporia, lots of other frequencies too, and always streaming at kansaspublicradio.org. You can also tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. Lots of ways to access us. We've got an app. We even have an app. Let me clarify that. One for iOS, one for Android. Check it out wherever you get your apps.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.